Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it is Wednesday, first hour time for Middays with Mark, Congressman Mark Pocan, on with us for the hour, taking your calls. So if you have questions, thoughts, curiosities, comments, whatever, for Congressman Pocan, his website, pocan.house.gov. You can tweet him at Rep. Mark Pocan, M-A-R-K-P-O-C-A-N. Congressman, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
Great to have you with us. So you have on your website, you've got a piece about members of Congress urged Trump to stand with Americans on Nissan's anti-worker campaign. I'm curious about that and about just in general, what your thoughts are on what's going on in Congress. You are in the midst of the zoo, it seems.
Oh, my God. I wish, you know, zoo, at least there's some organization to it.
Yeah.
You know, with what's going on with the administration, you know, we get the mooch for 10 days. They throw out, you know, the chief of staff. He's back to, you know, now we find out he's dictating the response for his son about, you know, his meeting with Russia. I mean, just every week, last week was a really big week, right? Mm-hmm. From the Boy Scout speech to the police speech to, you know, all his going after Jeff Sessions. And then it just kind of continued with the mooch and, it's becoming more and more difficult to predict, if you ever could predict, what this administration is going to do. You know, then they'll tweet out something about, you know, discrimination on people serving in the military, which with no advance notice, but then, you know, they'll give advance notice on things that'll never happen. So it's hard to read it. Specifically to what you asked about, you know, on the Nissan, right now there's an election going through April 4th for a union. This is down in Mississippi, and there's been a lot of pushback by the company on this, you know, taking people into meetings, telling them that, you know, the company might move, all these other things that you're really not supposed to do in the middle of a union election. And, you know, they've been already promised a lot of things, that they should have good wages. I know this area well because I grew up in, and by the area, I mean auto industry. I grew up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where, you know, 14,000 people out of 70,000 used to make cars. You know, it was American Motors for when I was growing up. Then it became Renault Alliance, and it became Chrysler. And now no one makes cars there. And when you look at something like this in Mississippi, you know, they bring in these temp workers first. So the wages are really low. They're advertising like $13-14 to start, which is unheard of in the auto industry. They tell you you'll then get the official wage, but you've got people who have started there at $24-25 on the official wage, and 14 years later, they're making $26 an hour. There's been like no real increase in the wages, and that's why people are talking about having a union. But, you know, there's been a lot of really questionable tactics by the company to make it harder to form a union.
Oh, amazing. I'm curious your thoughts on the North Korea situation. I don't know if you caught the announcement that was just made on green cards.
No, I have not.
Okay. North Korea, Tillerson came out and said, we are not your enemy. We want to tamp this down. Although you are pushing our limits of our tolerance. What is your sense of what's going on?
Well, I think this is one of those areas where the best way to deal with this would be obviously through working collaboratively, especially with China, who can put pressure on because so much of their economy in North Korea is contingent on Chinese goods. And we could, through good diplomacy, do more to make sure that we don't have a questionable leadership of a country with nuclear weapons, right? Especially that can reach the mainland. The problem is, we've had, I think, a pretty combative approach through tweets, unfortunately, by the president with China on this issue. And I don't know if that's really getting us anywhere. I think I did see that, I believe it was the CIA director, I don't want to say something wrong, but I thought that's who it was, had made a comment about how we are for regime change. And then you've got Tillerson saying, no, we're not talking about regime change. I don't think we should ever be talking about regime change in other countries like this. It's just not really our role to do that. But the fact that we're getting mixed signals like we do so often from this administration worries me about what the next steps could be.
Yeah. There's a new website out there. It's titled departmentofinfluence.org. And it drills down. It's created by the Western Values Project, which is a group that is pushing back on the exploitation and privatization of the mostly Western public lands, but public lands in general. And they drill down through Ryan Zinke into all the people that he's hired. And it's pretty shocking. Person after person after person is basically a lobbyist. What is your sense of the kind of damage that is being done in the Department of Interior, the Food and Drug Administration? Next week, probably the Department of Labor, if the last two members of the board of the Department of Labor, or the NLRB, I guess, National Labor Relations Board, are confirmed, to that. It looks like they probably will be. What's your sense of what's going on?
Well, and this is the question, as much as Republicans say, they don't want regulation and, you have to get rid of two for every new regulation. You also, though, have to keep the regulations that you have, and at least the agencies that do the protections, because without regulators, you don't have clean air and clean water, and you don't have labor protections and safety addressed in the workplace. And in the case that they're doing, I think with public lands, I think there's a real effort to, again, with all the people in the administration that have connections through the oil industry, to open up public lands in more ways. We saw an effort by Jason Chaffetz before he left. He was talking about putting a bill in to sell 2.4 million acres of public lands off. And we know that there's been things through the Antiquities Act they've tried to do. So we have to watch this very closely, because I do think that their real goal is to pull back all of this to the point that you would have no or little regulation and things that people really support. I mean, everyone wants to have clean water and clean and food that's safe and a workplace that's safe. And if you don't have those things in place, you're going to have real problems. And yet I think that's the rollbacks that they're inevitably moving towards.
Yeah. It's pretty radical stuff. Okay. Congressman Mark Pocan is with us, taking your calls for the hour. It's our Middays with Mark hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Congressman Pocan represents the 2nd District of Wisconsin and does so brilliantly. He's also the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And you can find his website at pocan.house.gov. You can tweet him at Rep, R-E-P, Mark as in representative, Rep Mark Pocan. And we'll be back with more of your calls for Congressman Pocan right after. And welcome back. Jared, watching us on YouTube. Hey, Jared, in Downington, Pennsylvania, what's on your mind, Jared? You're on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Yes, hello, Tom, and hello, Representative Mark Pocan. I'm calling today because something recently in the news. Trump recently signed H.R. 3364, Countering America's Adversary Through Sanctions Act. It is a bill that imposes congressional sanctions on the governments of Iran, Russia, and North Korea. And I just want to know why exactly Congressman Mark Pocan voted for that bill when it could potentially kill the Iran deal and push us into conflict with North Korea, and along with maybe starting a new Cold War with Russia. Not that I necessarily oppose everything in the bill, like I don't have necessarily a problem with taking the power away from the president to remove sanctions. But a good percentage of the bill is also very awful, such as the parts that talk about sanctioning anybody supporting the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. But I just want to know why exactly Congressman Mark Pocan voted for that bill, and I'll take the question off the air.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, thanks for that question, Jared. Let me just say, I mean, if you look at that bill, the vote was unbelievably lopsided.
I think there were six votes in the House against it and two in the Senate. Am I remembering correctly?
And the reason being is, you know, we originally had a vote in the Senate that we were really trying to make sure we get the sanctions on Russia, because clearly the president, even as he signed it, said he thinks it might be unconstitutional, which, again, this is a guy who's just doing everything he can to subvert what we're trying to do to put some pressure on Russia since they interfered with our elections. I mean, clearly we have to have a response in that way, not starting a Cold War. I mean, there are some clearly who do want to do that, right? Some of the Republican senators, as they talk about this, but the vast majority of Congress doesn't want that. So rather than getting lost on what this bill maybe could do, I can tell you that a lot of thought went into the additional provisions. I was one of the people on the whip team to make sure that we could deal with the Iranian deal. I would never do anything that would put that at risk. We've got a president who I think continually wants to put that at risk. We put some very careful language that they needed to add to get it out of the House, but we needed to have the sanctions in place for Russia, and quite honestly, North Korea needed something as well. Sanctions, don't forget, we belong diplomatic solutions rather than military solutions. If we didn't do it, we might very likely be waiting for this administration to very unpredictably do military action, and then we're really in trouble. So I think that's why you saw such a giant lopsided vote. And, you know, I'm still not sure the president's going to live by it. He may have signed it, but, you know, let's face it, following everything with Russia, we know he's got something to hide, and he's going to continue to do everything he can to make sure it's not exposed.
Yeah, it seems that way. You know, refusing to release his tax returns and everything else. He added a signing statement to it, you know, basically saying, I think this is unconstitutional. Does that make any sense?
No, I mean, so that's the thing. Everything he does, from, you know, the lies most recently about, you know, him dictating the description of what his, you know, son's meeting was with Russian officials, where his lawyers said it didn't happen. Now we're finding out it did. You know, there's so many lies out of this administration, mostly and largely around Russia. I mean, I'm a simple guy from Wisconsin, but it doesn't pass the smell test, you know,
yeah.
Where I come from. If it doesn't pass the smell test, there's probably something that stinks. And this thing, and I think when you see something, it stinks.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Middays with Mark Hour. Congressman Mark Pocan taking your calls on the topics of the day. And Dan in Oceanside, California, you are on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Thank you. Tom, I love everything you do. Congressman, thank you for spending the time with us. There's a H.R. Bill 2366, which would allow being able to discharge this student loan through bankruptcy once again. Is there any chance of that ever seeing the light of day?
Dan, thanks for your question. You know, this is an issue that I don't quite understand why there's a disconnect between the parties, because to me, some of the stuff around student debt should be a no-brainer. You know, I introduced the first bill back in 2013 to allow people to refinance student debt. People are paying 6.6% interest when the current rate was around 3.5%, and it just doesn't make sense that you can refinance your home and your car, but not your student loan. Some of these other issues, like you brought up, H.R. 2366 and some other measures, should be pretty much nonpartisan, no-brainer. You know, if people do get a higher education, the odds are they're going to make more money, which means they're going to pay more taxes, and there's a lot of benefits to it. Yet, for some reason, it's been really hard to get people on the other side of the aisle to join in. Now, Elizabeth Warren has done a refinancing bill. Senator Gillibrand from New York has done a a refinancing bill. Mine is the only one that does have some bipartisan support, but I think we're only talking 3 or 4 Republicans on the bill. It's just been difficult, Dan, and I don't quite know why that they're seeing this as a disconnect. I know some of the rhetoric that I used to hear on the budget committee around this was that they just don't want everyone following the path of college, and we know not everyone does. 30% of people do, and the other 70% don't. But I don't understand why this issue hasn't been something that to gain more support. So I wish I had a better answer for you, Dan, because it doesn't make sense to me either.
Michael in Troy, New York. Hey, Michael, you're on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Thanks, Tom. Long-time listener, first-time caller, and Congressman Pocan, great to talk to you. And I actually retweeted your comment about the wall earlier today. My question has to do with agency confirmation and Senate confirmations. We're hearing speculation that the president might move one secretary from one agency to the other. And I guess I'm confused. Is there a blanket approval that once you're approved for one department head, you can easily be moved? Or will this require additional confirmation by the Senate? And how does that not, what about their qualifications if they're going from vastly different agencies? I'm confused.
Yeah, Michael, great question. And, I actually listened to part of yesterday's press conference where the press person reiterated that they would not be moving Jeff Sessions to Homeland because that was one of the speculation, right? And then there also was another speculation. They said that they didn't know if there was a move in works. You know, the question is, I think, a fear that he'll try to do a recess appointment while people are out and put someone in. But, there's supposed to be a confirmation process. I don't think you can automatically go from one to another. That's why, you still would have to have normal Senate confirmation. But what we're really watching, and we all should be watching, is that he does anything to pull Jeff Sessions from Attorney General so he can put someone else in who could fire Mueller, who's doing a really, I think, great job on the investigation he's working on. So
that's the theory, isn't it, that he's going to move Sessions from to replace Kelly over to DHS?
They gave us yesterday in the press briefing, they give you wiggle room on it. This one was no wiggle room, that it's not going to happen, they're saying. But again, with this administration, I don't trust much of what they say.
Yeah.
So that's what we're really watching, because I know he is desperate to put someone in as Attorney General who will get rid of Mueller, again, because of the Russia investigation.
Yeah, indeed. Mike in El Paso, Texas. You're on the air with Congressman Mark Pocan.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Congressman. Want to say thanks to both of you for serving the public so well as you do and speaking up for the truth.
Thanks,
Congressman. I just wanted to know. It just seems like with every day we have more and more volumes of things coming forth about the corruptness and the criminality of this president. And I know Bob Mueller's a good man, and he is utilizing all the tools at his disposal to try to uncover everything, but there may be so much you might not ever get to the end of it. So I guess my question is, when are we going to have enough where we're going to actually start seeing either impeachment proceedings or, in my view, better yet, criminal indictment before this guy can continue to advance his agenda even further, which seems to be headed for calamity?
Yep, Mike, great questions. Let me say it this way. We're going to need the Republicans to put their country before their party in order to do something while they're in control. Quite honestly, Paul Ryan needs to grow a spine. He used to stand up to the president during the campaigns, and now he rolls over and gets his belly rubbed, and that seems to be where we're at with the House of Representatives leadership. To get something like impeachment, to really get what this independent counsel that we want, you're going to have Republicans step up to do that. And it may be that if we can't get to that crucial point where he just pushes them over the edge, we have the November 18 elections coming up. And I think there's a reason why we have Democrats announced in over 200 of the Republican districts already, and they have Republicans announced in Democratic districts in something like 20. It's like a fraction of where we're at, because people really are upset about what's going on, and that may be the best opportunity to push something forward. I would hope that they'll rise to put the country before their party, but unfortunately, I'm not seeing a lot of it happen in Washington, and really, that's extremely discouraging. As someone who actually believes in the process enough to run for office and serve in office, you'd expect that you might be able to get that done, and so far, unfortunately, it's not working.
Yeah. We just have a little more than a minute until the next break, Congressman. Not enough time to put a caller on, and it's a hard break at the bottom of the hour. So quick question. We had Iron Stash on this show yesterday, and I'm sorry I don't have my one sheet in front of me. I think I remember his name, but I don't want to get it right.
Randy Bryce.
Randy Bryce. There we go. He was talking about you coming into the district. He sat through at least one of the town halls you did for on behalf of Paul Ryan, and he spoke very well of you. I was wondering your thoughts on him.
Yeah, he's been to a couple of them. I'll tell you, this is the first honest-to-goodness real challenge Paul Ryan has had in my memory. That my hometown is in that district. My husband's family lives in that district. I know that district second to my own. And Randy fits the district like a glove. You know, he's an iron worker. That's a district that's been largely deindustrialized. They lost 14,000 auto jobs in Kenosha, about 10,000 in Janesville. This is a guy who can talk to people at a very authentic, real level. And I think he's a very serious candidate. And if he has the resources, I think he could give the speaker a run for his money. This is the speaker who wants to get rid of health care for tens of millions of people that aren't asking for it. And Randy's the antidote.
Yeah. And he's plain spoken, very straightforward, and yet has clearly a sophisticated grasp of the issues. I was just really impressed. So
yeah, no, he's exactly what we need in Congress.
Yeah. Amen. Congressman Mark Pocan with us for the hour, taking your calls. We'll be back right after this break at the bottom of the hour with more of your calls for Congressman Mark Pocan. Stick around. By the way, his website, pocan.house.gov. You can tweet him at Rep. Mark Pocan. He is also the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Welcome back. It's our Middays with Mark, our Congressman Mark Pocan, the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Congressman representing the 2nd District of Wisconsin, pocan.house.gov. You can tweet him at Rep. Mark Pocan on the line with us, taking your calls for the hour. And Russell in Hickory Hills, Illinois, you're on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Thanks, Tom. Mr. Pocan, I wanted to ask, if you talk to your colleagues in the House, what you guys are going to do if he goes through with this threat of taking your health care away from you in the Senate, because that sounds like a pretty stiff threat. And I thought Obamacare, he can't stop making payments on it. It's in the bill. If you had a comment on that, have you talked about that, about when he takes your health care away?
Yeah, Russell, thanks for your question. So, you know, first of all, how to win friends and influence people, generally taking away the health care of the Republicans you're trying to get the votes for, it would not be the recommended course. I think the problem is he just gets mad, right? And he tweets or he bursts out with some kind of a response that he never plans on actually executing. I think the real question is, when are they going to get with us to fix what needs to be fixed? Because clearly the House did a terrible vote. They took that would take away health care from tens of millions of people and make older Americans pay more. And really, it was all about a big tax break for the wealthiest and for insurance companies and big pharma. But, you know, they're desperate to just check a box that they got rid of Obamacare, and they need this money to start their tax reform. What they really want to do, which is take care of their wealthy donors and the wealthy companies in this country. So, you know, whenever we need, what we're trying to focus on, and I think you're starting to see this, the Help Us committee, the subcommittee on in the Senate is looking at doing some bipartisan conversations. You've got to at least keep the Affordable Care Act going. You have to keep those amounts that get paid to the insurance company that's subsidized to make sure that people have health insurance so people don't lose it. I'm seeing some movement there. I'm hoping at some point that'll break through. I've been really disappointed in Paul Ryan, once again, saying the House won't do anything different. We've already voted on it, rather than recognizing that their plan is a failure. But I think a lot of it's bravado by the president, desperate to have a win, to check a box that he got rid of Obamacare, and to start the tax cuts for the wealthiest. And, you know, you're going to hear a lot of rhetoric between now and then. I think it's tough to get a lot of the Republicans to go that much against their constituents enough in some of these swing districts. So we've got promise. We just have to keep the pressure on. People have to keep calling their members of Congress.
Bob in San Luis Obispo, California. You're on the air with Congressman Mark Pocan.
Thank you, Tom. Congressman, there was a very lengthy, detailed article in Vanity Fair about the sheer ineptitude of the Trump administration simply going into the Department of Energy, not talking about all the other departments. And, I mean, the first people they sent over there didn't even have the necessary security clearance to be briefed. is there anything that holds this administration accountable for not staffing the government agencies to the levels that has always been the normal way of doing things?
And if I could add to that, I've seen reports that Rick Perry did not realize that the Department of Energy was in charge of our nuclear stockpile, our nuclear weapons, when he took it over. I mean, could that have something to do with the problem, or were those just, you know, snarky fake news stories? I frankly don't know. Congressman?
No, my guess is from Rick Perry that is true. Not exactly a confidence builder, is it? I do see this across all departments. We're having a problem that he has not made the appointments of political leaders in these areas across the board. So while they're complaining the Senate hasn't approved some of the people they put out there, some for good reason, you have to have a review, they haven't filled a number of these positions. And for the first time ever, we're seeing this where, you know, generally what doesn't get interfered with during all the politics of policy is the casework we can do for constituents, helping them navigate federal agencies. We're starting to have problems there in our office that we never had before, simply because they're not making the appointments they need to. So I don't know if some of it is just incompetence by, again, the Trump administration, because we've seen plenty of it. I don't know if some of it might be intentional in some agencies to slow walk it, but it's becoming a problem across the board that we're seeing. And, I think that's going to be an issue pretty soon that will rise to the level that Republicans are going to see this as well in Congress, that they can't get casework done for their constituents.
Okay. Marcia in Englewood, Florida, you are on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Hi, Congressman. So good to see you.
Hey, Marcia.
There's a couple issues regarding. I know that they're going to start working on the tax code. I don't know when, but it's on their minds now. There's a couple issues in the tax code that really bug me something awful. And the first one is every time one of these big corporations gets hit with a multi-million or multi-billion dollar fine, they're allowed to deduct that on their taxes. Am I correct?
I'm not sure about every fining. I couldn't say that definitively.
I think it's just incredible that not only don't these people that do actually criminal offenses against the American people, they don't go to jail, but they can deduct the cost of those penalties, however many billions they were charged, they can apply to their taxes as a tax break. That's one tax break that I totally disapprove of. Another one is when I was a working person, I'm 74, I'll be 75 soon, so I haven't worked in a long time and haven't filed taxes in a long time. But when I did file taxes, my medical bills had to reach such an astronomical amount in the last few tax filings of my working experience that I couldn't deduct them. I could not deduct my medical expenses because they did not reach the threshold. I don't see why people earning less than, let's say, $250,000 have some crazy threshold that they have to meet of medical expenses in order to be able to include them in their tax deductions. Those are two things that really boil me.
Congressman?
Sure. No, I hear you, Marcia. And the first one, I'd have to check, because I don't know if I could say that of all fines, they're all deductible. And for some reason, I think they're not from something I've heard, but I just don't have that information handy to offer up. What I can tell you is, you know, they desperately want to reduce taxes on the wealthiest and on corporations. You know, the goal that they want to reduce the corporate weight way down, because we have one of the highest in the country, allegedly. The problem is that's on paper, but when you take all the different exemptions that are out there, like you've mentioned, the effective rate really is more like 16, 17, 18%, somewhere in there, which is about half of what the actual rate is. So I can tell you this. I think it's going to be it's very difficult for them to really get in there and do this, because every group that's fought for an exemption doesn't want to give it up to lower the rate. It's going to be a giant political fight. If they thought healthcare was difficult, I guarantee tax reform will be more difficult. But that's part of why the initial so-called healthcare bill they put out there had that giant tax cut to start what they're trying to get towards in relieving taxes for, quite honestly, it's their donors and their voters, the wealthiest in this country, and not for everyone else. So I think, you know, there's a lot of individual tax deductions we could point to as absurd, but more we have to be careful of what they're trying to do, which is they'll give us a penny or maybe a nickel in tax breaks for the middle class and those aspiring to be in the middle class, and then all the real money will go towards the wealthiest and for big corporations, and that's not the direction we need to do on the tax code.
Todd in Chicago, you're on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Hey, go Marcia. I like what she had to say, first off, and thank you both. Hey, real quick, Randy Bryce, what is the DCCC doing to support him? Because in the past, they have always had a hands-off approach to Paul Ryan and just kind of let him continuously get reelected. There's been no effort to put forth a Democratic candidate, and this guy is coming from the grassroots effort. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure. So generally, generally means there's exceptions to the rule, but generally the DCCC doesn't get involved when there's primaries. Technically, there is still one other person in the primary in Randy's race. However, having said that, NARAL, for instance, today endorsed Randy Bryce. I think that came out as a release. He's getting, SEIU, the momentum is all on his side. The Progressive Caucus made our first endorsement being Randy Bryce. A lot of other big organizations have as well. So I think our conversations with the DTRIP have been not so much, I think, that they're trying to stay away from Paul Ryan, but that, in some cases where there's someone who's clearly going to be so far ahead of anyone else in a race, and like in this case, it's a real race with a real candidate, they should probably pay attention. So that's kind of the conversations that many of us have had with the DCCC. It's not so much that they've left Paul Ryan alone, as they didn't see it as a winnable seat because of some previous candidates, or there could have been a primary, and they don't, again, they're not supposed to generally get involved in primaries. We're trying to make a case that Randy is the real thing. This is a real race. A guy who's not in his district very often. He wrote a health care bill that is going to take away health care from tens of millions of people.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your questions for Congressman Mark Pocan in our Middays with Mark Hour right after this. And welcome back. Bob in Davenport, Iowa, watching us on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Yes, Mark, I want to thank you for introducing the Voter Roll Integrity Act.
Thank you, Bob.
I'm working hard to find co-sponsors across the country and to see about getting some people in the Senate to sponsor one. I've had some conversation with Bernie Sanders' office about that, and hopefully he may do something. But I really see this as the way to save our democracy. And I think you'll probably agree, but I'm trying to imagine like what the opposition might drum up as opposing arguments to the Voter Roll Integrity Act.
Oh, they'll probably claim, Bob, my guess is the same reason why they did interstate cross-check to begin with, right? That somehow there's people voting more than once, and we've got to get rid of the people. Remember, I mean, to this day, Donald Trump is still claiming illegal voters were more than the 3 million votes he lost by because he's desperate to claim he actually won the election. They'll do something along those lines. I think what we need to do is just show the facts that it's been proven that they've dumped people off of the voter rolls that were incorrectly dumped over and over and over again, and that really this was an attempt to do just that, to dump a bunch of legal voters off that they thought weren't going to be their voters. So I think we just need to keep taking those facts and figures out there and try to get more sponsors for the bill and get the word out on this. But I agree with you. I mean, those democracy issues are really at the core, because if we don't have a democracy, a lot of these other issues are definitely going to go down for us, from tax reform to health care to infrastructure and everything else. It's important that everyone be able to vote who can vote, and that we don't set up artificial barriers that we see right now set up across the country.
Rick in San Jose, California, you're on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Hello, Tom. Congressman Pocan, thank you for all that you're doing. I'm very pleased to know that there are still representatives out there like you, and I'm hoping that there'll be many, many more. I am calling about the Democratic overall strategy for 2018, 2020, and beyond that I think should be immediate, aggressive, and broadcast very loudly every single day starting right now, because of I'm in terror of what's coming up in 2018 and then 2020 with the census and all that. Where, other than Nancy Pelosi's statement, where is the huge Democratic immediate plan to bring back my country?
Yeah, Rick, so this is one where I am optimistic. I think something I've seen that I'm encouraged by is that the congressional Democrats and the senatorial Democrats are on the same page, understanding that at the core, we need to have a good, strong economic message, and that much will go from there. In Wisconsin, we had a 200,000 Democratic voter drop-off in the presidential election, second only to Mississippi. And we used to be one of the top three for turnout states. But we didn't have a good core economic message in 2016, and we had a lot of voters who stayed home. So the fact that the Better Deal proposal that's been put forward by Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi on behalf of Democrats in the House and the Senate really gets at a lot of those core economic issues, that if we can re-engage with voters that we are there fighting for the middle class and those aspiring to be in the middle class, and we can explain everything from antitrust to wages and all the rest, I think we can make that case.
There you go. Congressman Mark Pocan taking your calls right after. More of us right after this. Welcome back. It's our Middays with Mark Hour. Congressman Mark Pocan taking your calls. And Tony in Albuquerque, New Mexico, you are on the air with Congressman Pocan. Tony? Tony's not listening to his phone. You got to listen to your phone. Gizmo in driving through Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Well, thank you. Congressman, actually driving through Ohio, but that's okay. I'm a trucker somewhere in America. I'm definitely a Bernie-crat, Congressman, and I was just curious here. Now, you've got a caucus in the Congress and one in the Senate trying to fix the ACA at this point. Are you a member of the Congressional Caucus to fix the ACA now?
Well, I understand Democrats in general, we have said we're willing to sit down if they'll bring us to sit down, because we have plenty of ideas and suggestions. Some, they're going to be a little more progressive, like having a public option that I don't know if the Republicans would go for, but a lot of other ones. There's a subcommittee in the Senate, the HELP subcommittee, that Senator Patty Murray and Lamar Alexander are the chair and the ranking on, that are working on something. And then there's this no labels, what do they call themselves, problem solvers caucus, that allegedly is working on it, but Paul Ryan's already said they're not going to look at any new proposals. We're sticking with it. So the activity is on the Senate right now, unless Paul Ryan suddenly decides he's going to stand up to the president, which I don't see happening. So what we're really watching is those conversations that they're having over August. But we have said at any time we are willing to sit down and have a real dialogue about what needs to be fixed around the ACA so that tens of millions of people don't lose health insurance. And we're still open to do that.
We, the Democratic Party?
Yes. Yeah,
and so there isn't a specific caucus within the Democratic Party devoted to health care?
No. I mean, I think what the gentleman's referring to in the last week, there's been news about the HELP subcommittee in the Senate and that there's this problem solvers, no label caucus that's generally of people who are in competitive districts who are trying to show they work across the aisle working on something. However, again, it's not Paul Ryan has been very clear that they're not going to do anything different in the House. So all the action really would be in the Senate, and they still haven't done their vote. So that's what we're watching the closest.
Yeah. Tom in Towson, Maryland, you are on the air with Congressman Pocan.
All right. So because what Trump was made from society, how are you going to fix it with reform?
I'm sorry. Could you ask that question again, Tom? I got a little – it went out for a second.
Right. So because what Trump is – because Trump is a result of society, how would you what is your plan to fix?
Tom, do you mean like Trump, many of Trump's behaviors are reflections of dysfunction in our culture? So how can you fix that without fixing our culture? Is that your question?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Tom, I mean, first of all, I don't really feel that Donald Trump is reflective of the country, at least as I see it and the people I talk to. I think there are there's an element, right? We know when Barack Obama got elected, we had a part of it was this anti-government part of the Tea Party, and part of it was outright racism that created the Tea Party, and that's been really our huge downfall since 2010. I think Donald Trump really was reflective, of this kind of populist, xenophobic, some people feel like they're losing grasp of being in power in this country. That's a big element of what he has, but that's not the majority of the country. That's why he can do pretty much anything and hold on to 35% or 36%, but not much more than that. And the rest of the people are concerned that the direction he's taking us is directionless, and it's more based on, you know, some ideas that pop into his head or he tweets out. So, again, I don't think I agree with the premise that he's reflective of society. Certainly there are some in society who don't like the fact that our culture is changing and maybe different people will be in power in the future, and they don't want to give up for white males. But I don't see that him as really representative of the majority of society.
James in Orlando, West Virginia. You're on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Hartman. Thank you, Mr. Pocan. You're doing a great service for your country. I'm a disabled Vietnam veteran, and I'm sitting here looking at the VFW magazine on page 12. The Trump administration is going to cut the benefits to 225,000 vets. It don't look good for us. I know. I guarantee you those vets had to fight every inch of the way for their benefits. And it says here they're going to take, let me see this, $3.2 billion away from these vets next year. That's going to really hurt us. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I'll tell you, James, if I can offer maybe a little more general, because this is something we've seen happen even pre-Donald Trump. So this is the Republican Party, and Donald Trump is symptomatic of it as well. They don't believe in public institutions. So they want to take money from the VA system and put it, for example, towards choice is what they call it. But it's taking money away from a system that works well for veterans and saying you can go to other doctors with it. But every time you take away that benefit, that institution that we provide that benefit for, the more we risk providing those benefits. So I think that's been something that happened even pre-Donald Trump, that there's always lip service, right, about veterans. But we don't, let's face it, we don't pay people well in the military compared to all the military contractors. And then we often don't want to take care of people after they've put their service in for this country. And we're seeing that slide happen again. So I guess I'd just say, James, it's not unique to Donald Trump. It's kind of symptomatic of the current Republican Party, and that's why we need to push back. You know, even my Tea Party uncle, after he goes through all the complaints about the federal government, he usually ends it with, but leave my VA alone. We need to protect those benefits for people who served us. Yeah.
Congressman, we have just a minute and 15 seconds or thereabouts until the end of the hour. Your thoughts on what's coming up that we should be paying attention to, what the pressure points might be, where we should be calling our members of Congress, the big things that we should be looking for going forward and doing for them?
Yeah, I think for this month, because it is the month we're not around, we've got to be afraid of what could happen without Congress around. So is that any of those recess appointments and be ready to act? And I know the indivisible groups, for example, in this area, they're so organized. I love it. They put out something. If announcement happens before 2 p.m., there's a rally at 5 o'clock that day. If the announcement happens after 2, it's the next day at a certain time. They're getting ready for it. We need to be ready for that. And we need to be ready for whatever might happen on healthcare in case they try to pull something really fast by calling the Senate in. Let's just remember, even though it's allegedly the congressional recess, we've got to watch it even closer so they don't pull something fast on us. Be ready to contact your members of Congress. Be ready to act.
I have heard stories that in order to prevent, Trump from, for example, firing Jeff Sessions and then recess appointing somebody to replace him immediately, which he could do if the Senate goes into recess, that the Senate specifically was, whether it was Mitch McConnell being upset with Trump or whether it was Chuck Schumer, forcing it, might not go into recess. You know anything about that?
I just assume they're assuming the same thing. With this president, anything could happen, and we got to be vigilant.
So they're going to cover their backsides. Fascinating. Congressman Mark Pocan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Of course, Tom. Thank you.
It is such an honor and a pleasure to have you. Congressman Mark Pocan, you can tweet him at Rep. Mark Pocan, his website, pocan.house.gov. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And in the studio with me is Dave McCullough, partner with Capital Media Partners, conservative. His Twitter handle is DT McCullough, McCullouch.
O-C-H. Almost. Almost.
I got it right?
O-C-H.
That's what I said.
You said U. It's all right.
Okay.
McCullough like the chainsaw.
C.
Nobody gets that.
C-M-C-C-U-L-L-O-C-H.
There you go.
Okay. There we go. Well, that's funny. I'm hearing a funny little beeping. Oh, it must be your phone in my IFB. Anyhow, Dave, frequently debates me on television, and here you are in our radio studio. Nice to have you here with us, Dave.
Good to hear it. Yeah. Good to be here.
So I wanted to talk about solar power. Kate Aronoff wrote a great piece for The Guardian today. The headline is, "Utility Companies Won't Let You Sell Your Own Solar Power." Why not? The electric utility sector is broken, but the transformation we need will be virtually impossible so long as a handful of wealthy elites are calling the shots. And they point out that the electric utilities spent $114 million last year lobbying to end net metering. That is the ability of people who put solar panels on their houses to sell electricity back into the grid. And so far this year, they've spent $59.9 million. Now that if you look at Germany, which is, in fact, generated more than half of their electricity one day this summer from solar power because they incentivized people to put solar panels on their rooftops with what was called the 100,000 rooftop program, originally designed to replace one nuclear power plant. It grew so fast it replaced 10 nuclear power plants in the first 10 years, and they had to stop the subsidies because they just couldn't until they could upgrade the grid, which they did. And now it's like just off to the races. Germany is the cloudiest country in Europe. Germany is north of Michigan latitude-wise. It's Canada latitude-wise. And it is as cloudy as Michigan, which is one of the cloudiest states in the United States. And yet, they're generating half their power on a good day from solar power and doing it very, very successfully. Why should we allow the oligarchs who own the for-profit utilities in the United States to say, no, you can't do that?
Well, first of all, they built the grid. They built each power company's grid, which ultimately connects to all the other grids.
They did it on our public space, and they did it with Fifth Amendment takings, with eminent domain takings. That, you know, we gave them the permission to do that. We gave them the land to do that. So, don't they have some obligation to us?
I think they certainly do have an obligation as a public utility to provide power in exchange for money. And certainly, I agree that net metering is a general plus. It's a good thing. It's a good thing that we have the ability to make our own solar, and there's incentives. Typically, I believe in market-based incentives rather than government incentives, but it's a good thing. It's a very good thing. The challenge, and I want to take a little note about that lobbying figure. You said $100-something million was spent on lobbying against net metering. No, that was just in general, for the energy industry. And there's no doubt there's a lot of concern about the transmission lines. Our infrastructure has a lot of problems, a lot of challenges. We've seen rolling blackouts in California years ago. We've seen...
Now, that was a scam by a for-profit company. Enron did that, and they shut down power plants to create those blackouts to take down Governor Gray Davis, which they successfully did. And Ken Lay had a secret meeting with Arnold Schwarzenegger about a year before this all happened. When Daryl Issa found out about it in a press conference, he broke down in tears, you'll recall, because he thought he was going to be the next governor. Shouldn't we say enough with these private companies? About half the, just to set the frame, about half the electricity in the United States is generated by publicly owned utilities. And publicly owned utilities, by and large, are very, very aggressively encouraging people to solarize, put up windmills, whatever, you know, get into the grid, get on the grid. The private companies see this, rightfully so, as a threat. The public companies are committed first to serving the people. The private companies are committed first to making a profit. Shouldn't there not be a profit in something that is the commons, that is essential, literally essential to life, electricity in the United States?
That becomes a slippery slope then. I mean, at what point does a utility be socialized? It's crazy to think. A lot of people think now that internet is a public utility and the government has actually started to make rules. I mean, net neutrality is one of those things as well. At what point do we say, okay, well, all utilities then, if it's for the common good, should be government-owned? I don't think, if you start doing that at a certain point, you're going to end up just an entirely socialized country.
First of all, let's redefine terms here. It's not government-owned. It's owned by we the people, right? I mean, you know, the utilities are typically owned by local towns, counties, or states. And I'm not even sure there's any utilities that are state-owned, but usually they're locally owned. They have local boards of governors. Sometimes they're elected, sometimes they're appointed, but they're representative of the people. And you know, in terms of the slippery slope, I would say wherever there is a natural monopoly, wherever you can only get one thing, right? You know, whether it's septic, whether it's water, whether it's electricity, whether it's the copper coming into your home with broadband, I think that that should be regulated as a utility. And ideally, I'm not arguing for the nationalization of the internet, you know, of individual ISPs, although I could make that argument, but I'm not. But with regard to electricity, water, and septic, you know, the just core stuff essential to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, if we know, and we now know, I mean, there's just a pile of evidence that doing this on a for-profit basis not only doesn't produce the best outcome, but produces the most expensive outcome. So shouldn't we ban that? I got no problem with saying, let's just nationalize these. It wouldn't be nationalized, it would be localizing them, but, you know, I was living in Portland, Oregon, when the city of Portland tried to buy PG&E, which was not the whole West Coast, just the in Oregon. They tried to buy their local utility from Enron. And Enron was asking, I forget the amount, let's say it was $5 million. It was probably 50 or 500 or whatever. But they had an asking price, publicly stated. The city of Portland said, we will pay you the asking price. And Ken Lay said, we are going to refuse to sell to any government agency. We will only sell to another for-profit corporation.
Right, they're in to make money. I mean, I'm not sure if that's a problem or what. But if
it was
if the government came to me and said, "Well, Dave, you know, we want to buy your house."
Yeah, but your house is not part of the commons. And by the way,
maybe
the government, in order for the electric company to transmit electricity to my house, they may well have come to you and said, "Dave, we're going to buy your house, and we're going to give it to the power company. We're going to give it to Enron and let them run their power lines across it because we're going to put a transmission line through here."
You know, if the government said, "Like, we want your thing," whatever that thing is, I would say no, because it's my thing. And the government does not have a right. In some cases, I guess they do with power lines and eminent domain, right. But if I'm in the business of making money, which I am, any business is in the business of making money. That's the point of business.
Shouldn't anything that uses eminent domain, anything where your home and my home can be taken for the public good, doesn't that just imply right off the bat that this is for the public good, that this is you know, this is a natural monopoly. This is something that should be part of the commons rather than part of the for-profit sphere.
Maybe that can be kind of a theory going forward where you have new utilities or you're pushing for new utilities
in places that
are not currently serviced. But I very much vehemently disagree that the government should be going in and taking over utilities for even an asking a market price.
Why?
It's just not right. It's not right for the government to own and to socialize these things.
Why?
And whether it's a federal government, a state government, or local government.
I don't understand why. What is the benefit to you and me as consumers of electricity to having for-profit companies, you know, telling us that we can't have solar panels on our houses, which will save us money, telling us, no, we're not going to let you do that. When a government-owned agency would say, please do that. We would love to not have to build another power plant.
And that's going to be the difference, I think, in ideologies. Certainly,
you'd rather pay more in service of the so-called free market.
I'd rather have less government run things. I mean, the government can't run diddly squat correctly.
Oh, that's not true. The post office works great. Nobody's ever missed a Social Security check. The army is maybe not the most efficient.
Post office works horribly. Horribly.
Or I never failed to get a letter.
Take a look at Metro's Washington Metro system, the subway system here. It's owned by. It's run by three different one entity that is run by the governments of D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. All three put money in this thing.
Part of it is those funds are determined by Congress, and the Republicans in Congress have been short funding Metro here in D.C. for over a decade. And as a result of that, the maintenance that was supposed to be done never got done. I mean, I agree with you. If you're going to have a government-owned utility, in this case Metro, at least fund it appropriately.
Funding is important, absolutely. But at the same time, you have government-run things, including not government-run unions, but you have these unions that are causing the metro system to catch on fire on a daily basis. I mean,
unions?
Yeah, yeah. The unions are.
You're talking about the union of Republicans in Congress who are cutting the funding to Metro?
No, I'm talking about the unions actually at Metro themselves, keeping on board these people who basically can't be fired for essentially killing people. Metro's defending.
So we've. Oh wow. I think we're wandering far afield.
We probably are. Ideologically, I don't think it's a good idea for more government to be taking over control of things.
Other than a reflexive hatred of government, which would imply a hatred of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln and all the people who brought us this government.
There is a role in government. It's not to run utilities.
Why not?
Why?
Because because they're answering to you and me rather than answering to stockholders. And, you know, I don't mind if my blue jeans are made by somebody who answers to stockholders. In fact, I think it's the best way, because blue jeans are not part of the commons. But my electricity, I would like to have some say in it.
And if a company says that they don't want to sell to the government, why should they be forced to?
Because, you mean they? Wait a minute.
You said in Portland.
If a utility that was a comment about how Enron was basically echoing your sentiment. We're not going to sell this to the city because we just dislike the idea of publicly owned utilities. Because there's kind of a war going on in the utility sector right now between public and private. But I still don't understand why you think that if government does it, it's bad. I mean, you know. Shouldn't we? I mean, isn't the whole point of representative democracy to make government work for all of us?
Shouldn't we also try to promote the idea that the free market economy, the thing that this entire country is based on, other than democracy, is a good thing? I mean, why do we want to have more government instead of less government? Why don't we want to have more people instead of government running these things?
Because it's better for our country,
isn't it?
Better for us. Yeah.
When government eventually takes control of our life.
Germany is producing half of their electricity from solar power. And we've got, down in Florida, they're trying to pass a law to say you can't sell any of your electricity in Florida.
Well, I think it's 42 states as of a couple years ago that allow net metering. And it's a very good thing. I think that it's a good thing to be able to use no power, then when you need some power, bring it back.
So you're in favor of regulating for-profit utilities to force them to do net metering?
I am in favor of reasonable regulations that make sense for everybody. I'm not in favor of government just willfully taking over.
Okay, Dave McCullough, Capital Media Partners. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I just want to go through some of the news that's out there today for a few minutes, and then we'll pick up your phone calls and kind of continue. Mark Sumner wrote a great piece over at Daily Kos today. The headline, I referenced this in my conversation with Bob Ney about 10, 15 minutes ago, but the headline, Trump and Sessions, Jeff Sessions, turned Civil Rights Division, that would be the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, which is charged with enforcing civil rights laws, into a weapon to protect white privilege. And the article says the Trump administration is preparing to redirect resources to the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division toward investigating and suing universities over affirmative action admission policies deemed to discriminate against white applicants, according to a document obtained by the New York Times. And so, yeah, they're going to start suing schools, that are doing what the Supreme Court said you can do and you should do, in fact, is, try to have a diverse campus. It's good for everybody. But no. Make America white again. It was just a typo, right? In his slogan, should have been MAWA, MAWA. Make America white. I mean, this is what it's all about. Jason Wilson, day before yesterday, wrote a piece in The Guardian titled, Young White Guys Are Hopping Mad. Confidence Grows at Far-Right Gathering. This was the so-called American Renaissance Conference that was held in Tennessee over the weekend, and calling for race realism and a white ethno state within the United States. This is very, very spooky stuff, but it is going mainstream. He's talking about this American Renaissance. These are white nationalists, white supremacists. And this weekend, American Renaissance held its annual conference in Montgomery Bell State Park, hour west of Nashville. Attendees and speakers clearly felt a growing confidence. They have seen appreciable growth in membership of established emerging far-right groups. They've also seen the election as president of Donald Trump. Some of the topics, race realism and race denial, as the white man turned the corner, the Trump report card so far. Many were millennials. This is disturbing. Though all attendees wore conference dress code, jacket, and tie, more than a few younger men sported the fashy haircut, as in fascist, short back and sides with a severe parting, which has become a signature of the so-called alt-right. Many such young men lined up for selfies with Richard Spencer, the president of the White Nationalist National Policy Institute think tank, who has achieved fame since greeting the election results with a cry of Hail Trump. And I would add, he did the Hitler salute. So there's that. Meanwhile, in India, this from Quartz, India, by Devyot Ghoshal. This is from a newspaper out of India. 59,000 Indian farmers have killed themselves due to rising temperatures, and it could get worse. And this is about farmers across India protesting, almost always clad in green, sometimes holding human skulls or dead rats. They've been attempting to lobby the Modi government for a relief package, including a farm loan waiver. One of the protest leaders said, due to a water crisis and drought, farmers are under a huge financial burden. We are almost destroyed. We don't care if we die protesting here. And then they, in the last three decades alone, rising temperatures and their impact on crop yields have been responsible for an estimated 59,000 farmer suicides, according to a new study by Tama A. Carrollton, a researcher at the UC Berkeley. So that's 60,000 people over 30 years. It's roughly 20,000 people a year committing, you know, farmers in India committing suicide because climate change is wiping out their ability to you know, raise crops and things. Donald Trump reportedly told one of his golfing buddies at whichever Trump-owned golf course he was at last weekend or the weekend before, you know, we spend millions and millions of dollars to transport the president to his property so he can advertise them and raise their value on our nickel. And he said the White House is a dump. Well, yeah, the White House was built in, like, you know, 1800, 1801, something like that. I mean, it was very early on. I think might have been late 1790s. I think John Adams lived there for a short time. Jefferson then moved in and whatnot. But George Washington didn't live in the White House. It was being built during that time. And in fact, you know, our first capital was New York and then Philadelphia, or maybe it was the other way around. And then we ended up with D.C. But Donald Trump talking about what a dump the White House is. So he has to get away from it on the weekends to go to his palaces, right? How disgusting is this? Let me quote to you from a handwritten essay that Barack Obama wrote on the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address when he was living in the White House. And I'm quoting from the president, President Obama. In the evening, when Michelle and the girls have gone to bed, I sometimes walk down the hall to a room Abraham Lincoln used as his office. It contains an original copy of the Gettysburg Address written in Lincoln's own hand. I linger on these few words that help define our American experiment. Quote, a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. End quote. Through the lines of weariness etched on his face, we know Lincoln grasped, perhaps more than anyone, the burdens required to give these words meaning. He knew that even a self-evident truth was not self-executing. The blood drawn by the lash was an affront to our ideals. The blood drawn by the sword was in painful service to those same ideals. He understood as well that our humble efforts, our individual ambitions, are ultimately not what matter. Rather, it is through the accumulated toil and sacrifice of ordinary men and women, like those like the soldiers who consecrated that battlefield, that this country is built and freedom preserved. This quintessentially self-made man, talking about Lincoln, fierce in his belief in honest work and the striving spirit at the heart of America, believed that it falls to each generation collectively to share in that toil and sacrifice. Now, to the best of my knowledge, nobody in the Trump family has ever, Obama continues, has ever served in the military. Obama continues, through Cold War and World War, through industrial revolutions and technological transformations, through movements for civil rights and women's rights and workers' rights and gay rights, we have shared in that sacrifice. At times, social and economic strain have strained our union. But Lincoln's words give us confidence that whatever trial awaits us, this nation and the freedom we cherish can and shall prevail. Trump, the White House is a dump. Obama, I'm walking these sacred halls inspired by Abraham Lincoln. Amazing. Rex Tillerson, I'll just the headline. I mean, you know, as Trump is trying to, apparently, there's an op-ed about this in today's New York Times, about how deadly dangerous Trump's attempts to destroy the Iran deal, simply because he wants to blow up any legacy of President Obama. He wants to wipe President Obama from the face of the earth, right? It just, you know, no memory. The Republicans, by the way, did essentially the same thing to Jimmy Carter during the Reagan administration. It just wasn't quite as explicit, and it didn't have the racial tone to it. But while Trump is trying to, you know, stir up war with North Korea, Rex Tillerson, U.S. Secretary, this is Katrina Manson writing in the Financial Times. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson used his lengthiest enunciation of U.S. foreign policy yet to reassure Kim Jong-un that the U.S. is not seeking to topple North Korea's supreme leader or his regime, and that Washington would like to sit down for talks. That's amazing. Rex Tillerson, maybe he's going to become a statesman. We'll be back.
Coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest news and information from Wall Street and Main Street, all points in between, plus the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, show up, participate, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.